I'm a huge advocate for industrial real estate. I love it as an asset class, but I also stress to people that the worst thing you could do as an investor is rush into something because other people like it. It takes a lot of prudence, diligence, and having somebody even helping you.
Real estate is about freedom, choice freedom, time freedom, and money freedom, and the impact you can make with that freedom. But it doesn't come without cost. Your freedom takes work. That's why Neil Timmons brings together the tools you need to build your real estate legacy, from tips and tricks to interviews with industry titans. It's all here in one place. Real Grit. Let's get to it.
Hey everybody, welcome to Real Grit. I've got Chad Griffiths here. He's an industrial real estate broker. He's a investor. He's a YouTuber. I'm excited to have him here because he's got deep experience. So I'm pumped. Chad, how are you?
I'm doing so well. And thanks so much for having me on. I'm equally excited to be here.
I'm pumped to have you here, man. Industrial, for those who know me, got a sweet spot in my heart. It's probably my favorite asset class because it's so hands off. But maybe before we dive deep into that, just tell me, you know, we all started someplace. How in the world did you even get started with your first investment property?
Yeah. So I'd been a broker for probably 8 or 9 years working in industrial real estate. I knew right away that I wanted to invest in industrial, especially since that's what the focus of my career was. And I had bought and sold some residential at a fourplex and some smaller things. But once I started getting into industrial, I really saw that as an opportunity. So it just took time to save up money, and as raising a young family at the time and trying to buy a house. So it just took time to really have the capital to do it. But bought the first property in 2014 and pretty much just been adding a property every year. That's the goal right now. We've got another one under contract. And just as long as we can add one a year, it seems like it's a productive way to keep growing a portfolio.
You're in a fourplex. You did some things in the residential side. What attracted you to actually put your money in the industrial side?
That's a great question. And it was interesting. When I first got into industrial, I knew very little about it. Like, I knew multifamily investing to some extent, and everybody can intuitively understand office and retail because we've all been in office buildings. We've all been in shopping centers. Yeah. I knew very little about industrial, but it wasn't until I started working with people that had successfully invested in industrial over several years, and you start just working hands in on it, which I was doing, you just get the understanding that you're dealing with corporations. So you're not dealing with small, no credit residential tenants. Mm-hmm. You don't have beholden by any residential tenancy act, which are heavily skewed in favor of the tenants. Yeah. Like, try and evict somebody in the middle of winter, it's virtually impossible. Whereas industrial, you're following contract law for the most part. So yep, whatever the contract spells out, it governs that arrangement. And you got longer term leases. So I kind of looked at this saying, okay, well, you can rent to corporations. You don't have to worry about tenants not paying rent and not being able to evict them. You can do longer term leases. And we could talk about triple net. I don't know how often you've covered that already, but they're triple net leases. So you're protected from any increases in property taxes or building insurance. And you just have the ability to scale much more because you're buying bigger properties versus buying. Example I always love to give is a property we bought 2 years ago, leased to a single tenant. It's a large company that leases it. And it would cost us about $3 million to buy that property. And the equivalent multifamily property would be like a 15 unit multifamily building. Mm-hmm. Well, imagine all like the stress and headache and turnover that comes with managing 15 residential tenants versus us having one large company that leases this property for us. It's much easier to scale because we're not as hands-on. We don't have to spend as much time managing and doing all the turnover on it. Those would be the main reasons why I was so attracted to it. And starting, I guess we're 8 years into our journey now, building out our portfolio, I can't think of anything else that I would have enjoyed and had been less stressed with than industrial has been.
Yeah. So on the apartment side, let's just liken it, you know, a small fourplex, and residential has been going up substantially in values, right? The counties come in, they reassess you. All of a sudden you get a new tax bill and the taxes go up 30%. And that's coming out of the landlord's pocket. You now got to stroke a check. Rent rates, although they're going up, they do bounce, right? Up or down. Sooner or later, they may level off or they may even fall. My tax bill is very slow to come back down anytime soon, right? They don't like giving money back to you or reducing, you know, what a government actually spends at any level of government. But on a triple net deal, it's different. You've got a built-in level of protection given the lease. Maybe expand upon that for those who may not understand what a triple net is and where I'm going with this example.
It really is fundamental to investing in industrial or commercial real estate in general. So I'll try to do it as succinctly as I can in the explanation, but let me know if I'm going too slow or too fast. Most commercial leases and the majority of industrial leases are structured in what's called triple net. It can be called a number of different things depending on what market you are. So the terminology isn't as important as what the premise is. Mm-hmm. And the premise is that tenants are going to pay two types of rent. They're going to pay one rent, which is sometimes called their net rent, can be called base rent. Again, it can be called a whole number of things, but that's a contractually agreed upon rate that they'll pay for the whole term of the lease. Mm-hmm. So it can be a flat amount, and usually it's in per square foot. So it could be, call it $5 a square foot for 5 years, or there could be yearly escalations that are negotiated in advance. So maybe it starts at five and it goes to 10 by the end of 5 years. That's agreed upon. That doesn't change. Whatever the contract says is what it says. The second component of what they'll pay in rent is the proportionate cost of operating the building. So that's property taxes, building insurance, common area maintenance, such as landscaping and snow removal, and then also property management fees. So those are all the costs that any property owner has to pay to just operate that building. And if it's a freestanding building with one tenant in there, that tenant will just pay for all those costs. If it's multiple tenants, they just pay based on their proportionate amount of space that they occupy. But the key thing with that is that they also pay any increases. And in theory, they could get a refund if there were decreases over what that budget amount was, but that doesn't happen a whole lot.
No.
But they will pay any increase in property taxes. So that example where a city goes in and reassesses the property, gives a 30% increase in tax bill. If it's a true triple net lease, and that's how the contract is written, mm-hmm. that increase flows directly through to the tenant. So it allows a property owner to have the comfort of saying, I've got a 5-year tenant or a 10-year tenant in here. And regardless of what happens with the property level expenses, those are going to get passed through the tenant anyways. So I know that my base rent is going to be free from being eroded by any increases in those expenses.
You can mm-hmm. better account for what the return is going to be and extrapolate that over a period of years versus the challenges associated with residential and properly budgeting out what numbers look like on a forward looking basis ultimately.
Even just one more point on why commercial and industrial looks favorable. I don't know if you have it in your neck of the woods. We don't in our area either, but a lot of municipalities have rent control for residential. So you can only even mm-hmm. increase your rent X amount. So even if the city comes and hammers you with a tax assessment increase and they take more money out of your pocket for that, on the other hand, they prevent you from even increasing it to keep pace with that.
Right.
Whereas most commercial and industrial, there's no restrictions. The government doesn't typically like getting involved between business to business transactions. But anytime homeowners are struggling to pay their rent, that's their voting base. That's where they typically put the most attention. So far anyways, doesn't seem to be a lot of appetite in the government to come after those commercial and industrial leases.
No, on the business side of things. Maybe give me your take too on this. To me, it seems like there's no doubt industrial extraordinarily attractive, which is why we have holdings in industrial. But for the average person, they just don't know enough about industrial. They grew out of houses, right? All of us interact with a house, you know, have a house or we have an apartment. You lease or own one or the other. You interact with it every day in some capacity. And so for most people, it just seems like the next bridge is another house or an apartment. And for a lot of people, they just never even look or get turned on to industrial. Is that your experience as well?
Absolutely. And in fact, I'd say that that's an inherent barrier to entry is the fact that it is so unfamiliar to the majority of people. Yeah. And the favorite thing that I've heard described about it is I was talking to a guy, brought up the fact that I was working in industrial real estate. And he said, the only thing I know about industrial real estate is when I make a wrong turn off the highway and I end up in an industrial park and I have to try and find my way back to the main road. And I think a lot of people, that is their familiarity with it. Maybe they've been in like a mechanic shop or like an older industrial building. Now you're starting to see these big distribution centers go up off the highway. Yep. So everybody's seeing these big million square foot buildings go up. But unless you had a direct reason to study this, there's no course, there's no program that you can just go and become an experienced or knowledgeable industrial real estate investor. I think that is in itself a barrier to entry where there's less competition chasing the industrial properties versus a multifamily property as an example that might come up on the market. Well, in theory, every real estate investor in that market might be interested in that property. Like you said, you're familiar by living in a house, perhaps investing in a house. It's not a quantum leap going to a multifamily property. So there's a lot more competition. And I think that's another reason. We should also talk about some of the negatives of industrial real estate investing, because right now I'm painting this very rosy picture on all these reasons why it's positive. But that is certainly another one, is that there's just less competition because less people know about it.
Yep. There's positive negatives each direction. direction, no matter which way you go, and certainly risk and rewards. You know, industrial, continue to compare it to apartments. You know, somebody moves out today, you could almost literally fill it inside the same week. Mm-hmm. It takes nothing to get somebody else to fill that space. To fill a 20, 30, 40, 50,000 square foot industrial space, somebody's not coming this week, most likely. There is a period of time associated with that. There's vacancy associated with that.
And it can even be a lot more detrimental from just the scale of it. So going back to that one tenant in there, mm-hmm. if that tenant leaves at the end of their term, that's 100% of the cash flow that tenant is taking with them.
Correct.
Versus a 15-unit apartment building where one tenant leaves, it's not nearly as impactful. You're right. And I think that does speak to the risk. I'm a huge advocate for industrial real estate. Like you, I love it as an asset class. But I also stress to people that the worst thing you could do as an investor and in your investing career is rush into something just because other people like it. I still think it takes a lot of prudence and diligence and having somebody even helping you, like whether it's a mentor or somebody that's already done it in your market and you're perhaps just piggybacking off their experience. It's not something you want to rush into because as good as it is, when that pendulum swings the other way, it can be devastating too.
Have you been to the vault? RealGritVault.com. Listen, we've got multiple guests who come on and oftentimes they bring us little tips, tricks, tools, scripts, Excel calculators, a multitude of things, and they share it. They share it for you. You can get them totally free, totally free. RealGritVault.com. Never been on the show who's brought everything. It's all behind the vault. Get it. RealGritVault.com. Yeah, there's no doubt about that. Outside of vacancy and what you see, you know, the longevity to place somebody, backfill space or single tenant risk, if you will. What else do you see that somebody else should know about or should give consideration to before investing in industrial?
Yeah, even starting right at the beginning, the process of acquiring an industrial property is a lot more arduous than just a multifamily apartment building. Yeah. If you find a multifamily building, you could probably go through your due diligence fairly easily. Whereas an industrial, you're probably going to need to get an environmental report. You're probably going to need to get a building condition assessment, which is a more sophisticated building inspection where they give you a lifespan on how long everything's going to last. And then they give you a budget on what you can expect. That's just a much more comprehensive document. You'll probably need an appraisal. You'll probably need to have a lawyer reviewing any leases or any documents in there. And all those reports come with time and cost. Sometimes a property owner, if he's selling, he might have some of those reports. So I'm not saying that it's necessary on every property, but if you're buying a property from an unsophisticated seller, and you have to commission all those reports yourself, you could easily be in the $10,000 range of just due diligence costs. And if for whatever reason, something doesn't check out, that could be a sunk cost. There's a lot more that's required to go into it. And if you miss any one of those steps, you could be opening yourself up for a lot of risk as well. I think it's just the fear of the unknown is real. Because it's not even just that it's unknown, it's that it's complex and it's complicated. But that doesn't mean that it's still not a very viable opportunity. Yourself, myself included, and many, many successful investors that I've met have just committed to figuring that process out. They've looked at it saying there's risk, there's undeniably risk, but there's also all this upside. And if I can safely navigate through this risk, this is just a better investment vehicle than having to deal with the portfolio that we have right now. If we were to put that all in the multifamily, we'd have hundreds of tenants. And I can't even imagine how stressful that would be when I've got a still a job as a broker trying to manage hundreds of tenants. That was just overwhelming for me. So I look at it that yes, there's risk, but there's all these reasons why I think the risk is worth taking.
You know, one of the things as an investor that I think a lot of people just skate over is ROT, return on time. You touched on it at the opening, is the stress level, just the ability to internally manage, if you had to manage 100 or 200 tenants, or just even oversee a property manager that has to handle those things, because there's just a whole number of moving pieces associated with that. Your ability to scale looks quite a bit different than a box, if you will. That's what I like
Absolutely.
To refer to as. Yeah.
And indeed, going to that thought process of mitigating risk, there's things you can do as well that if you're buying a property that you feel is always going to be attractive to the market as a whole. It's somewhat general purpose. You know that the next tenant that can come in, it's not going to require a huge amount of money. Most leases will stipulate that the tenant has to give you 6 months notice if they don't intend on renewing. So you'll usually have 6 months of a head start where you can start marketing it to other tenants. So it's never seamless as it is, like you said, with an apartment building, you could turn it over in a weekend. It's never going to be that seamless. There's always going to be some delay between getting the last tenant out and getting the new one in, but you can still mitigate that to some extent. But that does speak to, in my mind, The biggest single risk that an industrial property owner has is that they buy a property that is perhaps great for the tenant that's in there right now, that user that's in there, it works perfectly for. But at some point, and I'm a believer in this, is that every tenant will eventually leave.
Yes.
Could be 5 years, it could be 50 years, but every tenant will eventually leave. And what's that property worth either to release it to another tenant, or if you decided to sell at that point, what's that property worth vacant, as opposed to looking at it just through the lens of the cash flow that's coming in right now? And there's, I could tell numerous stories of properties that were purpose-built for the company that was in there. And perhaps they had some unique manufacturing process, or they had something that was just specific to what they required. But in doing so, it made it less desirable, or perhaps even undesirable, to the next round of tenants, unless a considerable amount of money was spent to retrofit it. Especially new investors don't calculate that component. They just see, well, this tenant's been in here for 20 years. They have a 10-year lease on here. This is awesome. I can buy this stream of cash flow and it'll look great. But they don't run through that exercise of what's that property worth if they leave. That, in my mind, is the single biggest risk in industrial.
Let me put another example on that just to give people a different picture. You know, imagine you're buying a McDonald's, and if McDonald's, the operating business, leaves, who's going to backfill it? McDonald's has this thing built out exactly for them. You know, Burger King is not going in there and going to just leave it exactly as it is. Burger King has their own process, right? Their own, everything looks and feels different. The whole thing's got to get redone or leveled in that scenario to be able to prop back up. And you're right that the what it's worth, because it's been modified to the exact usage of a specific user, makes a difference versus, you know, imagine just a big giant shell, if you will, and you can move a whole bunch of things in, a whole bunch of things out. Doesn't require that much modification for somebody, the building, the shape that is.
Yeah, you're
absolutely right.
Oh, sorry. The first investment property that I bought was actually a small industrial condominium, and very cheap, actually. I think we spent about $330,000 on it, and then we had to spend another $70,000 separating some utilities and things. But we were into it for roughly $400,000. But when we had a tenant in there for 5 years, and it was a company that fixed kitchen equipment. So they'd try to either go to the location of the restaurant, and if they couldn't fix it, then they'd bring it back to their shop, and they just had parts and everything in there. When that company left, we turned it over to a machine shop that with like CNCs and lathes in there. And that's a completely different use. Like, one was kitchen equipment repair, and the next one was machining. And all we had to do on that tenant was cosmetic work in the front office space. The bay itself worked perfectly for what they needed to do. We didn't need to change any power. We didn't need to change anything. We probably spent $5,000 on cosmetic improvements, and that was it. So if you can buy the right property, like you were mentioning, and I apologize again for cutting you off on that. I had that story come to mind real quick. The bad ones, like the really, really high profile risk ones, are the ones where, like, can you imagine if that kitchen equipment repair company had some unique thing in there and it was built for them, and I had to go and spend $100,000 retrofitting that for the next tenant. Now you're into a property for $500,000 when it's probably still only worth $400,000. And that's if you even have $100,000 just kicking around to do it.
Correct.
So I think that's the biggest risk. It is also easy to get around that risk if you're just being diligent with it. Like, if you're just going through the process.
Very manageable.
Yeah, it is manageable risk. There's not much risk in this business that you can't foresee or plan for, provided you're just doing the right steps all along.
Is that people get excited about an industry, they jump in and they buy the wrong product. They buy the wrong thing.
I've got one more quick story actually on this to point that as a good example. So it was a guy that I know that bought, it was roughly a 20,000 square foot industrial property in a smaller market. So my city is about 1 million people, and the smaller suburb, bigger city, was about 20 minutes away. So it's still, call it the greater area for our market, but still a small market. And there was a really good tenant in there. It's a large, like, international construction company that was in there. He bought it when there's 4 years left on the lease. And after 2 years, the tenant came and said that they were vacating the building because they didn't need it any further. They still paid their rent because they're contractually obligated to, but they vacated that property after 2 years in the lease. Because it was an older industrial property in a small market, 20 minutes outside of the major market, it's still vacant to this day. So he collected 4 years of income, 2 years when the tenant was in there, 2 years when it was vacant. And I haven't even actually talked to him to see where this story is at, because he's not making any cash flow on this now because the lease has expired.
Yeah.
They haven't been able to find another tenant for it. Not only now does he have a property that has zero income coming in, and you can go through the real estate math just to say, would this have to lease for now? What does that result for in the value? Like, you could go through that exercise, and it's not a good, it wouldn't be a fun exercise to do. But on top of him losing all the income that he has in it now, dealing with a property that's worth less than it was when he bought it, he had a provision of his insurance that he has to drive to the property every 2 days just to make sure that nobody's broken in or there's no broken pipes or anything with that property. And for him, it's only about 20 minutes from our city, but where he's located in the city, it's about an hour and a half round trip for him.
Oh my God. So
every 2 days, he has to drive out there, go into a property that's not making any money, which is like a painful reminder for this guy. An hour and a half every 2 days, he has to do that drive. Again, now he's the bigger problem. That's a hassle and a nuisance for sure. But the bigger problem is who's going to eventually buy that property.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Tell me, cutting your teeth as a broker for 8 years before you bought your first property, what was the number one skill set or experience that you acquired that was most applicable to investing?
I think it's identifying that downside risk by understanding what tenants wanted. That's still all I do on a day-to-day basis, is just working with tenants that are looking for space. So you start getting a really clear understanding of what's important to them. Is there a minimum ceiling height that they need? Is there a minimum amount of marshalling area where they need to have their trucks get into the building? Is there a minimum amount of power that they have? Is there an optimal configuration for office versus the warehouse space, or the site coverage ratio? So how much extra land is out there? For anybody that's getting into industrial real estate or considering it, that would be the first recommendation that I'd have, is get a really, really good understanding of strengths of a property as well as potential limitations, because that's where you're going to identify that major downside risk. So unequivocally, without reservation, I'd say getting a solid understanding of what tenants want.
Yeah. What's the demand? And then then from there, you figure out how to fill that demand with, call it supply, with your building, right?
I'm a big believer that real estate in an investment context is only worth some function of what a company is going to pay to use it. If a company is going to pay X, well, you can create all kinds of models that it's going to be worth Y. First, have a tenant that's going to be willing to pay something for it, because a vacant property, is that guy that I just mentioned, is not worth a whole lot. So I think understanding what users want in a property is step number one.
Yep. No, I would agree with that. We got 8 buildings today. How many square feet roughly does that account for?
We're probably around 100,000 square feet worth of inventory. And I think at last count, we had 22 tenants. We have one property that has some second floor office space above the industrial. There's a handful of small tenants in there, so that distorts it. Otherwise, the one property you have is just a single tenant building.
Right.
The next largest property we have is a 5-tenant building. I just like that split of not having too many tenants to have to deal with.
Yeah, it makes things a lot easier. There's no doubt about that. So as a result of having 100,000 square feet at this point, when you look forward, where are you headed?
The goal, like as I mentioned at the beginning, is pretty simple. I don't like complicating things unnecessarily.
Yeah.
So the goal is really just to add one property a year. We're trying to get one of the tenants to renew as the main condition in there. That would close out this year's goal. Right now, I've got my money in there.
Yep.
And I've got partners that are equally committed, and then we've got a bunch of debt as well. But at some point, it'd be interesting to go the syndication route, or perhaps do a fund and try and raise money to buy properties in other markets. I'll reach a limit in everything that I own is within 15 minutes of my office.
Sure.
I'll hit a limit on just how many properties I think I could even get in my specific market. And I'll also just hit a cap on how much money I can put to it.
Sure.
So I think if I were to do some sort of syndication or some sort of fund, then you've got more of a broader opportunity to pursue other markets, invest your capital to try and do it. That could be a ways away, because right now we're busy with our portfolio as it is and still day-to-day job.
What does your team structure look like in order to manage what you currently own?
So we manage a couple of the properties ourselves. So it's just my partner and I manage them. And then we've actually got two different property managers that take care of the rest of the portfolio. And those are on the properties where there's just more tenants,
Just
more things that can come up and more things that you have to deal with. It's a bit of a split. And then, our accountants are, there's never a shortage of, it seems we're doing some sort of reconciliation or bookkeeping all the time. And that just, it seems like that's always something that we're having a discussion with.
Yeah, there's a fair bit of accounting that goes into these things, and triple net basis when you're paying for this and who has to pay what each month. Yeah, on the reconciliation. Yep. Yeah. That's a much more granular conversation for another day with us in the audience. How's that sound?
Yeah. We might lose a few people if we start getting into the nuances of accounting.
The easiest component surrounding that is the shortcut is hire competent third-party property manager and you don't have to think about it.
Absolutely. Especially when we factor in that if it's a true triple net lease, you're charging the tenant for the property management on it. There's cases where some people will self-manage and then they'll try to put their hand into the cookie jar and charge say, well, this is our management fee. Right, we'll try to do that, but we don't. On anything we self-manage, we don't charge that management fee into the operating expenses. But if we have a property manager in there, that absolutely is going through to the tenants.
Right. Yep. No doubt about it. Let me do this. I want to move on to the final segment, what I call 4-4 impact.
4-4 impact.
Your favorite quote, it's not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man, right? Yeah, the credit belongs to the man who's actually in the arena, whose face is marred with dust and sweat and blood. Roosevelt said it. What about that resonates most with you?
So at one point, I actually had that entire quote memorized, and there's quite a bit more to it than that brief excerpt there. I was just so fascinated by the fact that people love to talk. People will love to say, well, you should do this or you shouldn't do that, or this is how I would do it. And that's that critic. It's not the critic who counts. It's the person that's actually going out and doing it. I've just always, if I'm trying to ever dispel any recommendations or advice, if someone's ever looking for it, I'm always trying to be cognizant that if I haven't done it, what right do I have to comment on whether someone else should or shouldn't do it? But there's a lot of noise in this business. There's a lot of people that are, you know, selling courses or selling programs and telling you how you can get rich in real estate. And maybe they have, but I would much rather listen to somebody who's actually doing it versus somebody that's just hypothesizing on how it could be done. That quote, I read that from Roosevelt a number of years ago. I couldn't say it verbatim now, but at one point I could. This is how I need to live. It's just, you need to be doing things as opposed to just critiquing others that are doing it and thinking that you could do it better. You just got to get out there. And the Nike slogan, just do it. That's how I look at it. Nike took that entire quote by Roosevelt and shortened it to three words.
What do you think holds most investors back from hitting their personal next level?
Fear. I think it's fear. And in some cases, probably justified. If an investor is considering buying into an investment and maybe their contribution's $100,000 and they only have $110,000 in the bank, they should be afraid. Like, that's, in my mind, that's a scary proposition.
Correct.
So whether it's justified or whether it's just in their head, because there could be a scenario where there's an investor that has to put up $100,000, but they have $400,000 in the bank, but they think interest rates are rising, so the real estate market's going to collapse and all these things are going to derail their investment. So even though they could comfortably afford to, they're afraid to for various reasons. Yeah. And that goes back to, they could criticize, they could say, well, this guy's going to lose all of his money by investing in it, so I'll just let him do it. I think that to be a successful real estate investor, you need to become comfortable with some level of risk.
Yeah. Outside of real estate, what are you most passionate about?
I'm really enjoying two things right now. I started playing guitar again. And so I used to play guitar when I was younger. And for various reasons, whether raising a family or just getting busy with work, I got away from it. But I started playing guitar a couple months ago, and I'm really enjoying that again. Just that creative outlet of, we're so number driven and analytical during our day to day that having that creative outlet, I think, has been healthy for me. And then I started a YouTube channel a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And I think it's similar, is that it takes that creativity, like you have to be creative to make something that other people might find interesting or educational. And I just found that, like, that left brain, we use our left brain so much in our business,
right,
that to use that right brain, that creativity side, I've just really enjoyed both of it. So for similar reasons, both guitar and making fun videos.
Yeah, that's great. What's your favorite way to make an impact in the community?
I think just being present. I've volunteered on a number of different boards and committees over my career. And the ones that I think I've had the most impact on aren't ones where I necessarily wrote a check or raised money. It was ones that I physically took time to do, spending time in the community or whatever it was. I think being present, especially for me anyways, has been more important than just writing a check.
I want to talk about the Real Grit Vault. We've got a vault of tools, tips, tricks, resources available for folks at realgritvault.com. And you're contributing to the vault, a net effective rent calculator. It's in an Excel format. Maybe for the folks, tell them what it is and how they benefit from this.
Yeah, net effective rent is another way of just calculating from both standpoints. You could calculate from the tenant side or from the landlord side. But the whole idea with the net effective rent calculator is that you're accounting for free rent. You're accounting for any tenant improvement that might be going in there. From the landlord's side, you'll also account for commissions that get paid out, any of the other expenses, so that you can figure out what your net effective rate is versus the face rate. And for a tenant, where that could be helpful is that if you're considering two spaces, but one's offering you some free rent up front, or they're offering you a higher tenant improvement allowance, you can compare the two of them to see what you're actually paying over the term of the lease. And if you're the landlord, you might be looking at two different deals that have come in, and you could run that calculation again to see which one financially anyways is better. I've spent a lot of time putting that together in Excel so that it auto-populates a lot of the data, and it's just very user-friendly. Yeah, it's happy to provide that, and I use it myself regularly.
No, it's great. Quite a contribution. Thanks, Jen. I really appreciate your time to connect up here. You got a fun story. I love where you've come from. I cut your teeth in brokerage, where I did as well, and then how you applied that on the investment side and then where you're headed. It's exciting. And I know you put a lot of good content out there as well. So for people, they want to find you, they want to follow you, they want to connect, where can they go? What should they do?
YouTube is best. If you just search industrial real estate, I'm probably one of the first ones that show up. There's just not a lot of people putting out content on there. So I applaud you for the content that you're putting out there to add to that body of knowledge. But yeah, just searching on YouTube would be best. And then I'm also active on LinkedIn. So either one of those would be great.
Perfect. We'll get those links put together so that people can find you here in the show notes as well. Chad, thanks so much for taking the time. It's been a lot of fun here. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I love chatting about industrial real estate. Great questions, great discussion. Thanks once again for having me on the show.
No, my pleasure. For everybody here at Real Grit, I'm Neil Timmons, reminding you that real estate requires real grit. See you next time. If you like our content and want more, you can access it at realgritpodcast.com. You hear it guest after guest. Instinctively, you already know it. But let me call it out. The most expensive action is inaction. The real estate market is full of opportunities. You just need to uncover them. You can build a business that lasts for years, makes monumental impact in the lives of those that you love. It's not just about business, but about the freedom you get because of it. Have you ever heard the saying, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. I believe that partnering is essential. In fact, I partner with hardworking investors all the time. The point is that you can get a lot further with the right partner. Let me say it again, the right partner. If you've ever thought about partnering with anyone, or if you have a partner now, I encourage you to download my free Partner and Profit Guide, which includes the top 5 must answer questions to evaluate a profitable partnership. You can find it at www.legacyimpactpartners.com. I'll see you in the next episode.
Hey, it's Neil Timmons. I've got a question for you. Are you a fix and flipper and want to leverage your skills, build passive income, create bigger paydays? Maybe you buy and hold rental houses and you want to increase your income by working less. Maybe you're executing on the Burr methodology and times being what they are, you're finding more cash locked into a deal. Maybe you want more predictable profits, or maybe this is your first go at real estate. Well, I've got a challenge for you. The 20X Profit Challenge. It's hosted and taught by yours truly. I'm going to teach and show you over the course of 5 days in this totally free challenge how to 20X your profit. Lesson one's a game changer, multiplying your income and capital fast. Lesson two is the perfect plan. I'm going to show you how to be getting off-market 20X profit deals coming to you. The cash flow multipliers, lesson three, how to rapidly force appreciation and income growth. Lesson four is the deal accelerator, buying and holding profit guarantee properties. And lesson five, the wealth accumulator, consistently closing on 20X profit deals. I'm going to show you exactly my methodology, exactly what I did to go from where I was at, not achieving the results I wanted to achieve in my life, not achieving that passive income that I hoped for, that I knew I was capable of, and in 3.5 years, becoming financially free. I'm going to do that in a 5-day free challenge. To sign up, go to 20xprofitchallenge.com, 20xprofitchallenge.com. We've got one coming up. Go there now, register, it's totally free, 20xprofitchallenge.com, and I'll see you in the challenge.